Welcome to the HN Pod, your daily deep dive into the Hacker News front page.
Glad to be here.
Today is April 13th, 2025, and we've got quite the lineup today, looking at what's buzzing on HNN.
Always a mixed bag, isn't it?
Totally. We're going to talk about a Reddit bot driving someone nuts. Then there's this GPS alternative, BPS. Never heard of it before.
Interesting.
Okay. Also, an experimental Graphene OS release for the new Pixel 9a, a Python daytime library called Whenever. And wait for it, the dark side of the Moomins.
The Moomins. Okay, now I'm intrigued. Quite the range.
Right. So, yeah, let's just dive right in. First up, that Reddit post. A user basically shared this really frustrating experience with a bot.
Yeah, I saw that one. It sounded like they ran into some pretty heavy-handed moderation in a subreddit.
Exactly. Like, the moderation wasn't about discussion, more about pushing a specific viewpoint, removing dissent, banning people. You know the drill.
Sounds familiar, unfortunately. It taps into that wider conversation about, well, the enshittification cycle, as one commenter put it.
Right. That term. They mentioned seeing it happen before with places like GameFAQs, Dig, Slashdot.
Yeah. Platforms starting out great, community-focused, and then something changes. Monetization, maybe, or just sheer scale makes moderation break down.
It makes you wonder how Reddit's lasted so long, doesn't it? Someone pointed out it's like 20 years old and still growing, according to Google Trends anyway.
But is that real growth? That was the immediate question, wasn't it? How many are actual users versus bots or just alt accounts?
Good point. Hard to tell these days.
Yeah.
And there's this sense of loss in the comments too, like losing those old forums focused on actual knowledge sharing, especially for beginners.
Uh-huh. The kind of place you could go to actually learn something, not just argue or scroll past memes.
And finding old info is getting harder too.
Yeah.
Like trying to search for details on older web tech, it's just gone sometimes.
Yeah, digital rot. Or just platforms disappearing or search engines not indexing that deep history anymore. It's a real loss.
Then you've got the whole astroturfing thing. People mentioned seeing more of it, especially political groups. Trust in recommendations on Reddit seems way down too.
Absolutely. It gets harder and harder to know if you're reading a genuine opinion or, you know, some coordinated campaign. Erodes the whole platform's value, really.
One person even questioned the whole upvote system. Said it stifles real discussion sometimes. Needs heavy mods to stop it becoming just noise.
That's a controversial take, but interesting. They even argued for bringing back old forum threads, necroing them, which is usually a big no-no.
Yeah. Which made me think about Hacker News. I mean, HN has voting too, right? And shadow banning, apparently. So what makes it different? Or is it different?
Well, maybe the moderation style, the community focus, it's more niche maybe, or just the text-only format keeps some of the chaos out.
Could be. Someone mentioned the downvoting requirement here, needing 501 karma. They thought that might make it less militant compared to Reddit, where anyone can downvote immediately.
That's a plausible theory. It makes downvoting less reactive, maybe more considered. You have to be invested in the community first.
Another commenter listed the four horsemen for online communities: politics, religion, identity, and meta. Talk about the site itself.
Right, the topics that tend to ignite flames.
And they said healthy communities have filters against that. Informed users, active mods, small size, focus on getting stuff done. They mentioned Arbitrum Economics and Ask Historians as examples.
Two examples. Clear focus, strong moderation. It also links to that finding someone mentioned from a 2024 paper, young adults supposedly spending less time on deep reading online. Maybe focus helps engagement.
Maybe. We also heard that personal story, someone getting flooded with biased political stuff on Reddit before an election.
And then silence afterwards.
Yeah, that really shows how algorithms can shape your reality, creating those filter bubbles.
One user's solution just deleted their whole Reddit account, said it was too addictive.
Wow, cold turkey. Shows how powerful these platforms can be. And we got reminded about groups like Arthur Donald getting banned eventually for vote manipulation. So platforms do act sometimes.
Yeah, but often after a lot of damage is done. It's a constant balancing act for them, I suppose.
There was also this nostalgia kick in the comments. People missing older forum features, like more options than just up-down votes.
Uh-huh. And complaining that modern sites aren't great for long, deep discussions. Threads get locked. No way to track what you've read easily.
Yeah, exactly. Plus the issue of people with seemingly infinite time dominating threads, potentially driving others away.
The terminally online effect, where a few very vocal people can really skew the conversation, and they often know how to push buttons without quite breaking the rules.
People even discuss tactics used to control conversations, like needing special flair to post, or using downvotes or baiting to shut people down.
It's like a whole meta game of controlling the narrative within the community rules.
The original poster actually came back to explain why they reposted mentioned HN's second chance pool for a post that slipped through the cracks initially.
Oh, right. That's an interesting mechanism.
And others chimed in claiming there are huge bot networks on Reddit doing exactly what the OP described.
That's the pervasive fear now, isn't it? How much is real? How much is automated manipulation?
So much so that some people wondered if the original post itself was AI generated or marketing. New account, single post blog. Raised eyebrows.
Skepticism is everywhere. And that anecdote about someone's old Reddit account just vanishing? Weird. Maybe deleted old comments. Who knows?
It's telling that someone just flat out said the comment, "This feels like it was written by a bot," is basically standard on any Reddit thread now.
A sign of the times. And the OP also noted seeing more posts with half-truths or just made-up stuff getting traction with fewer people bothering to correct them.
Yeah, and the idea that some people just want the rage bait. Doesn't matter if it's true, it feeds something they already believe.
Like those ChatGPT stories on Remy the asshole getting serious replies. People engage with the narrative, not necessarily the reality.
The overall vibe felt like. Social media is more about tribes now than talking about what's real, and this longing for old-school BBS-style communities.
A desire for smaller, maybe more authentic spaces, less noise, less manipulation.
And get this, someone cited a report saying almost half of internet traffic in 2024 was bots. Maybe more bots than humans online now.
That's a staggering statistic, if true. Really makes you question everything you see.
Though some people shared the joy of finding old, niche forums still alive. Even just the endless threads can be a bit much sometimes.
Yeah, those hidden corners of the web can be great.
The fact that big companies are getting nervous about associating with certain online spaces says a lot, too. And the observation that maybe the English-speaking internet is hit hardest by bots and manipulation.
Interesting point. Maybe scale makes it a bigger target or a cultural factor.
Some practical pips came out, though. Using uLock origin filters to block annoying stuff, like U.S. politics on a finance site.
Taking control of your feed. Good advice.
And the classic advice. Step away from the doom scrolling. Go touch grass.
Always good advice. We even had that bizarre story about someone maybe driving a human pretending to be a robot insane.
So weird. And people who make new accounts for every single comment. Dedication, I guess.
And the dead internet theory popping up again. The idea that much of what we see is just paid actors pushing narratives.
It feeds into that story someone shared about doing guerrilla marketing years ago, paying people to have organic chats about products in public.
Whoa! Okay, that adds a layer.
And then someone else chimed in saying they actually managed fake social media profiles for a marketing company, building personas, controlling narratives during PR crises.
Jeez, that's direct confirmation of how it works. Someone even joked they were one of those fake profiles.
Yeah, and links were shared about state-sponsored stuff too. It's not just marketing bots. And the sadness that even niche places like our woodworking are getting toxic.
It seems to be spreading everywhere. That phrase, someone used LLMs as mimetic machines, kind of sticks with you.
Yeah, a bit chilling. And the thread ended with people debating if the OP's posting time was bot-like. The suspicion is just baked in now. So yeah, wrapping up the Reddit discussion, it feels like bots, manipulation, and just general distrust are really changing the feel of online communities. Big questions about where it's all heading.
Definitely leaves you wondering about authenticity and how to find genuine connection online anymore.
Okay, let's totally switch gears. BPS, Broadcast Positioning System. Ever heard of it?
Nope, first time for me. So it's a GPS alternative using TV signals, ATSC 3.0 specifically.
That's the idea. Uses the known waveforms from broadcast towers for triangulation, just like GPS uses satellites.
Okay, conceptually similar. What are the supposed advantages?
Well, because TV towers blast out much stronger signals than GPS satellites, it might work better indoors and maybe less prone to jamming or spoofing.
Higher power could definitely help with penetration and interference rejection. That's plausible. And they mention a timeline.
Yeah, something like 2027 to 2029 for potential public availability in the U.S., which isn't actually that far away.
But the comments immediately jumped on issues with ATSC 3.0 itself, right?
Oh, yeah. Big concerns about DRM digital rights management, like Google Widevine being built in, and needing an internet connection for some stuff.
Right. DRM on free over-the-air TV feels wrong to many people. And requiring internet, that undermines a key benefit of broadcast.
People worried about compromised DRM keys, too. Like, if the keys leak, does your non-internet connected TV just stop working?
That's a nightmare scenario for users without reliable internet. It highlights the risks of locking down previously open technologies.
Someone compared it to Aereo, remember them, got shut down, suggesting potential business model conflicts. And the question came up, does ATSC3 track users back to the broadcaster?
The Aereo comparison raises interesting legal and market questions. And tracking is a huge privacy concern, especially with that dedicated return channel built into ATSC 3.0 for usage reporting.
And maybe telling is that LG apparently decided to stop putting ATSC 3.0 tuners in their TVs. Slow adoption, no obvious picture quality jump for most people.
That's a bad sign for adoption. If a major manufacturer pulls back, citing lack of consumer interest or benefit, it doesn't bode well.
It made people nostalgic for the digital antenna marketing push during the analog switch-off. One commenter felt networks can sell anything if they market it enough, especially around sports.
Huh. Yeah, the marketing can be powerful. But others countered that linear TV viewership is dropping fast, especially among younger folks. Live sports is kind of the last bastion.
And just to be clear, we're talking about traditional broadcast TV here. The ATSC 3.0 stuff, not streaming services like Netflix or whatever.
Right. Different tech, different business models. This is about the future of antennas and towers.
And the feeling was strong in the comments. The user hostile parts of ATSC 3.0, especially the DRM, might just kill it. Maybe the old ATSC 1.0 will actually outlive it.
It's possible. If the benefits aren't clear and the downsides are significant, users might just not upgrade. Stick with what works, even if it's older tech.
Though technically, ATSC 3.0 does have better modulation and coding, so reception could improve for some people.
True, there are potential technical benefits on the signal side. Better error correction, potentially more robust signal.
But needing internet during a tornado to watch the DRM-protected TV for warnings, that seems insane.
Completely counterintuitive. Broadcast TV's traditional strength was being reliable in emergencies when other comms might be down. Radio was suggested as the backup, but reception isn't always great there either.
Someone pointed out the broadcasters are pretty open about their goal. Maximize the network return on investment. No bones about it.
Well, yeah, they're businesses. Tech decisions are ultimately driven by the bottom line.
And we got into some other tech tangents, like beamforming and Wi-Fi and 5G potentially seen through walls. Wild stuff.
Yeah, RF technology is getting pretty advanced.
And that dedicated return channel in ATSC 3.0, they detail the data structure. It reports on usage, intervals, even what you watch on your DVR.
Wow, so detailed tracking of viewing habits baked right into the standard. Privacy alarm bells definitely ringing there.
It was clarified, though, BPS itself is still experimental. Few towers focused on timing initially, not full navigation. The grand vision is a mesh network independent of GPS, but that's down the road.
Starting with timing makes sense. Precise time is fundamental for lots of things. A GPS-independent mesh network is ambitious, though.
And a reminder. The old ATSC 1.0 is lower res, 720p or 1080i, often with overscan. Plus, a shocking stat, apparently only a tiny fraction of U.S. homes can even get free broadcast TV anymore. Most is cable or streaming.
That really shows the shift. Over-the-air is niche now, which also explains declining cable subscriptions.
We heard stories from people close to cities who still couldn't get reliable digital TV signals, just gave up and streamed instead.
Reception can be really tricky. Buildings, terrain, lots of factors.
But then someone else had a great experience with cheap antennas, so maybe it's very location specific. And hey, it's free for now, and maybe more private.
True. If you can get it reliably, it has advantages. But those RF shadows are real, even near towers.
The core point, though, was about resilience. Having multiple options for navigation and timing is crucial.
Absolutely. Diversity is key. Relying solely on GPS is risky.
Especially when you see China with Beidou, terrestrial systems, fiber timing. Russia and China kept their ground systems while the U.S. decommissioned theirs.
That looks like a potential strategic gap now, doesn't it? Especially with GPS jamming becoming easier.
Yeah, the threat of jamming and spoofing is growing. Affecting aviation. Apparently, jammers are hard to counter effectively.
Very hard. More power or wider spectrum helps a bit, but dedicated jammers are tough, kinetically disabling them, complex geopolitically.
Someone mentioned aircraft using Earth gravity maps as a backup. How cool is that?
Very cool. Inertial navigation systems already exist. Gravity mapping could enhance that.
But back to BPS specifically, accuracy limits for 3D positioning, challenges with transmitters being close together. It seems tough.
Yeah, the geometry isn't ideal compared to satellites spread across the sky.
Leading to skepticism. Maybe BPS is only good for timing, just rebroadcasting GPS time. What's the business case for broadcasters without a government mandate?
That's the billion-dollar question. Why would they invest heavily in this infrastructure without a clear payoff or requirement?
One commenter guessed maybe government funding, making it essential infrastructure, could be the push needed.
Possible if it becomes part of national resilience strategy, maybe, but still lots of hurdles.
So BPS, interesting idea, potential benefits, but a long way to go, it seems. Technical and business challenges galore.
Agreed. Fascinating concept. Uncertain future.
Okay, next up, mobile OS territory. Graphene OS. They put out an experimental release for the Pixel 9a.
Right. Graphene OS, known for its privacy and security focus, supporting new hardware is always a big job for them.
Yeah. Sounds like integrating with the hardware, fixing driver bugs, especially around new stuff like hardware memory tagging, takes a lot of effort.
Absolutely. It's deep, low-level work ensuring everything talks to each other correctly and securely. Memory tagging adds complexity but improves security.
Apparently, new Pixel generations are easier because they're similar internally. It's the non-Pixel phones, even using Snapdragon chips, that are the real headache.
Makes sense. Consistency helps. Supporting the wider Android ecosystem with its variations in hardware and vendor software is much harder for a security-focused project like Graphene OS.
And they really stressed. The main reason they don't support more phones isn't just porting the OS. It's the lack of essential hardware security features and reliable updates from other manufacturers.
That's the key takeaway. It's not just about making AOSP run. It's about meeting their strict security baseline. Things like relocking the bootloader, timely patches.
Exactly. Most phones can run AOSP, but they don't meet Graphene's requirements for things like that bootloader relocking or consistent updates.
And the quality of the underlying Linux kernel drivers was mentioned too. Can be unstable, so Graphene OS sticks to long-term support kernels for stability. A sensible choice, prioritizing stability and security over bleeding-edge features.
It was clarified too. Graphene OS is a mobile Linux distribution, but running a standard desktop Linux setup on a phone would actually be less secure for mobile use.
Right. Different security models, different attack surfaces. Graphene is hardened specifically for mobile threats and the Android app environment.
Got a bit technical with Go Siskel handling, causing issues for some tools.
Yeah.
And then battery life. General take. Similar to stock Pixel on simple setups, maybe better. But complex setups with multiple profiles can drain it faster.
Fair enough. Battery life depends so much on usage patterns and installed apps.
Good news on banking apps, though.
Mm-hmm.
Anecdotally, they seem to work fine, often using Sandbox Google Play. Someone shared a neat trick using separate user profiles for banking apps.
That's crucial for usability. Sandboxing Play services helps bridge that gap for essential apps while maintaining isolation. The profile trick is clever.
Some potential downsides, though. Warranty issues after unlocking the bootloader, even if relocked. And some apps might not work due to safety net or play integrity checks. Always best to check compatibility lists.
Yeah, unlocking the bootloader is often a warranty gray area. And those Google integrity checks are a hurdle for any non-standard OS.
And a big one for some. Google Pay doesn't work, though alternatives like Curve Pay are apparently being worked on in the community.
A known limitation. Payment systems are tightly integrated and often rely on specific security attestations. Alternatives are needed.
Looking ahead, Pixel's moving to their own silicon away from Snapdragon might actually help Graphene OS long term. Less reliance on shared proprietary blobs, maybe?
Could be. More control over the hardware stack for Google might lead to cleaner interfaces for alternative OCs, potentially.
We touched on manufacturer access to chip vendor source code seems less open than in other embedded areas. And user experience. Pretty standard Android feel, most apps work. Camera quality in-app is the same.
Good to hear the core UX is maintained. Compatibility is key.
Device locking is heavily emphasized for security and robustness. Though one person had a scare with an unresponsive device after an update, but it recovered.
Locking is fundamental. And yeah, updates can occasionally go sideways on any system. Good it recovered.
Graphene stands on physical radio kill switches. They think software disabling is more effective against sophisticated threats. They were also critical of Purism's approach.
A pragmatic view. Hardware switches might provide false security against certain adversaries. It reflects their threat model. Different philosophies exist, clearly.
Backups generally work well. But limitations with apps using hardware key stores, like Signal. They're working on improving the backup system.
Hardware key stores pose a challenge for backups by design. It's a tricky balance between security and recoverability.
The headphone jack removal from Pixels still annoys some. USB-C headphones and DACs are the workaround, and core stuff like cellular Wi-Fi radios remain proprietary.
The headphone jack debate continues. And yeah, fully open hardware remains elusive for core phone components.
Rooting is possible, but discouraged break security, some apps block it. But they do support hardware virtualization, which is cool.
Rooting compromises the security model Graphene builds. Virtualization is a much safer way to run isolated environments.
Network location services are off by default. They use a privacy-friendly version based on Apple service, aiming for a fully offline one eventually. E911 works, but not the newer Android emergency location service yet.
Consistent with their privacy focus, offline location would be a big step. Emergency service support is complex.
And the final point made was crucial. Privacy isn't just for activists or whatever. Everyone deserves it. Location tracking risks are real.
Hear, hear. Privacy is a fundamental right, and tools like Graphene OS empower users to reclaim some control.
So yeah, the Graphene OS release for the Pixel 9a is another step in offering that high security, high privacy mobile experience.
A valuable option for users who prioritize those aspects.
Okay, a quick one now. A Python library called Whenever.
Right, saw this one. Pitched as a modern datetime library for Python. Key features: type date times and handling daylight saving times safely.
Exactly. Found on GitHub, username Aribovenberg Whenever. Seems popular, decent stars, forks. Latest release was March 2025.
Good signs of an active and potentially useful project. Datetime handling in Python can definitely be a pain point.
Used by over 100 other projects, lots of contributors. Mix of Python and Rust, interestingly. Docs available, MIT license.
Rust underneath Python suggests they might be aiming for performance or safety for the core logic, which makes sense for something complex like DST rules.
Yeah.
MIT license means it's easy to adopt.
And the benefits. Type date times mean clearer code, fewer bugs from mixing up types. And DST, well, it's a nightmare. This library aims to make calculations across DST changes much safer.
Yeah, types add robustness. And anything that simplifies DST handling is a win. Off by one errors or misinterpreting times around the switch are classic bugs.
So for Python devs dealing with time stuff, Whenever sounds like it's worth a look.
Definitely. A modern approach to a perennial programming challenge.
All right, last topic, and it's the Moomins. Specifically, an article in the New Statesman, The Dark Side of the Moomins.
Okay, didn't see that coming on HN. So what's the argument? That they're not just cute hippos?
Pretty much. The author argues the stories, while looking cozy, actually explore really complex stuff. Apocalypse, breakdown, family dysfunction, says they're often misread as just being about happy domestic life.
Wow. That's a take. I always thought of them as whimsical, maybe a little melancholic sometimes, but not dark.
Well, the HN comments had a range of reactions. One person agreed there are darker bits, but felt the core was still about family surviving weirdness together, flaws and all. They saw Moomin Mama as totally wholesome.
A more balanced view, perhaps. Acknowledging complexity, but still seeing the warmth and resilience.
Then you had someone who was genuinely traumatized by the Moomin series as a kid, said they still had nightmares, compared it to the X-Files, found specific episodes deeply unsettling, hated them.
Whoa. Okay, that's intense. Shows how differently kids can react. What's imaginative to one can be terrifying to another. X-Files level scariness for Moomins.
Wow. But someone else countered. Maybe being traumatizing to one kid is thought-provoking to another. And the fact someone cared enough to make a new account just to diss the Moomins shows their impact, right?
Yeah, that's one way to spin it. Even negative passion proves the work resonates strongly.
Someone else mentioned finding the Groke scary as a kid but not as an adult. That seems common.
Yeah.
And yeah, the stories aren't always happy.
The Groke is definitely creepy, silent, cold.
Yeah. Think about Moomin Papa's midlife crisis. Building a raft, moving house, Moomin Mama getting depressed. That's not exactly simple family fun time.
True. Those plot lines have real emotional weight. They deal with complex adult feelings, even in a children's book setting.
But the counter view is that overcoming those challenges makes the family stronger, shows a resilient, if imperfect, family. Is that just adults projecting, though? Especially how Moomin Mama bounces back maybe a bit quickly.
That's the interpretive question, isn't it? Are we reading our own desire for neat resolutions into it, or is that resilience genuinely baked into the narrative?
Someone compared them to Petsen and Vindus, another Nordic series, saying Petsen is more abstract, funnier, less about lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And the different Moomin TV adaptations came up. Polish stop motion got praise for capturing the book's magic.
Interesting comparison. And yeah, the different adaptations definitely have different feels. Stop motion often captures that slightly uncanny valley vibe well.
People noted rewatching as an adult can reveal a creepy undertone missed as a kid. Works on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. Someone drew a parallel to Peanuts' subtle depth beneath the surface.
That Peanuts comparison feels right. Simple art, complex emotions.
Fun thought. Moomin Valley has an upside-down bag end. Cozy, but weirder. Also, apparently lots of old Moomin TV episodes are just lost.
Upside-down bag end. I like that. And lost media is always sad.
And the coolest fact. Tove Jansson illustrated The Hobbit once, and her giant golem influenced Tolkien.
No way. That's amazing. Two fantasy legends intersecting like that.
Important point, though. The article focused on Jansson's books and art, not the TV shows. Though people obviously love the shows, too. No need to gatekeep the Moomins.
Good distinction. The source material versus adaptations. Both valid ways to experience it.
Someone even mentioned older Moomin cartoons having politically incorrect storylines. Sign of the times they're made in, I guess.
Yeah, that happens with older media. Reflects different sensibilities.
So the Moomins. Seemingly innocent, but maybe packing some surprising depth, darkness, and definitely starking debate.
Who knew? Definitely more complex than just cuddly creatures. A fascinating final topic.
And that wraps up our deep dive for April 13th, 2025. We went from Reddit bot madness to BPS signals, GrapheneOS security, a handy Python library, and finished in Moomin Valley.
Quite the journey through the Hacker News front page. Lots of different facets of tech and culture.
Exactly. Our aim here at the HN Pod is always to pull out those key insights from what the community is talking about, keep you in the loop. So here's a final thought for you. With online spaces getting ever more complex, full of potential manipulation, bots, and just noise, how do we actually figure out what's reliable anymore? How do we find real information and build meaningful connections in this digital world?
That's the challenge, isn't it? A really important question to keep asking ourselves as we navigate it all.